Good evening, folks, and welcome back on this mid-December Saturday evening, the 14th. I'm your host, Mark Hall. And tonight, rather than just talk about the big stories, like a nation gone insane, because that's arguably old news by now, we're going to ultimately go a bit deeper in another area because of, among other things, the incredibly effective efforts to use that insanity to cover up the stuff that's really important and being utterly ignored. So let me start off today with one of the biggest whoppers, or wappos, I've seen in a long time, to make the point. This comes ultimately from one of the most disreputable fake news outlets in perhaps the entire world, courtesy of the Gateway Pundit, too, the WAPO, which appears to think the American people are so stupid that they would swallow an op-ed penned by, well, none other than Mr. Fast and Furious himself, Eric Holder, the unindicted criminal that once headed the Department of Justice as Attorney General, where he was arguably the most evil scumbag ever to infest that particular office, with the obvious exception of Janet Reno, and furthermore, where his hatred for the Constitution and rule of law was so undeniable that he was even held in contempt of Congress. So what's the real story today, besides the WAPO admitting just how yellow to the core they truly are? Mr. Fast and Furious wrote an op-ed published Wednesday night by the whopper-overflowing Washington Post calling current Attorney General William Barr, are you ready for this, unfit to serve. Pot meet kettle. The mind boggles to the point where I'm honestly having trouble coming up with any kind of a hyperbole that doesn't sound trivial next to that one. Joseph Stalin calling Mother Teresa a murderer? Bill Clinton suggesting Captain Kangaroo is a sex fiend and child abuser? I just plain don't know. They all pale by comparison. And this, folks, is so blatantly self-serving, it goes so far beyond mere hypocrisy, way, way beyond George Orwell saying war is peace and freedom is slavery. Yeah, it's downright biblical, calling evil good and good evil this blatantly, even if the good here isn't really even that good. It just looks as pure as the driven snow by comparison, and maybe that's really the hidden agenda, what the WAPO's really trying to sell here. But you do have to hear this quote by the guy who, if we still actually had a rule of law, would be wearing an orange jumpsuit, not penning op-eds for the WAPO. Quote, the American people deserve an attorney general who serves their interests, leads the Just Us Department with integrity.
That's my story and I'm sticking to it.
And can be entrusted to pursue the facts and the law, even and especially when they're politically inconvenient and inconsistent with the personal interests of the president who appointed him.
That's my story. Oh, that's my story. Well, I ain't got a witness, and I can't prove it, but that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
I'm having trouble not gagging on this. William Barr, said Mr. Fast and Furious, has proved he is incapable of serving as such an attorney general. He is unfit to lead the Just Us Department. Unquote, and I need to go take a shower.
And that, folks, in all the years I've been doing radio, may be the biggest line of unmitigated BS I've ever actually been able to get through and read. And it was published as an op-ed by the Washington Compost. Who could have possibly believed they would sink this far? You have to ask, what kind of editor there would sign off on this? Why haven't they called this guy out? Or more to the point, what is the agenda that would actually cause them to insult the intelligence of their own readership, presuming they still have some that haven't turned away yet in disgust, with something this transparently, this insultingly asinine? I can't help but conclude there's only one real answer. They're covering for William Barr, who has in turn been covering for the deep state for years. Just ask the butcher of Ruby Ridge, if you can find him in the witness protection program, that is, just how apt a swamp critter William Barr really is. Trouble is, the WAPO now really has managed to paint him as an absolute saint. Well, at least in comparison to the likes of an Eric Holder. So yeah, I spent the time on that story because it really makes a deeper point. Something very big is up, folks, and we kind of have an idea what it is, especially by the amount of smoke that's being used to try to obscure it. Why, this has gotten so bad and so over the top that next thing you know, Nancy Pelosi will be wrapping herself in a copy of the Declaration of Independence and praying for the nation with Adam Schiff on CNN. Just please don't ask whether it's Baal or Molech they're invoking. Which, as promised, takes me to the sound of a can being loudly kicked this morning, even if the intent is to make it hard to see where and how far, much less by whom. But at least it looks like something we've seen a number of times before. A Trump cave. This time on the trade war with China and those really big tariffs that were supposed to kick in over this weekend, December 15th. But something changed. The question is, if we really ask the question, what? Oh, and hint, there are so many dots out there by now, the mind practically boggles. Writes Tyler Durden for Zero Hedge, just like that, confirming weeks of media speculation, President Trump has folded with the Dow Jones Wall Street Journal reporting that not only will Trump not impose those booga 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 new tariffs set to come into effect this weekend, December 15, but he'll also cut existing tariffs by up to 50%. Moments before the cave, according to the Wall Street Journal, Trump tweeted, getting very close to a big deal with China. They want it, and so do we. The China Global Times Twitter troll was delighted, saying, glad to see President Trump saying this. He quotes the tweet. But wait, there's got to be more. The trouble is, we just haven't actually seen it yet. Ask the skeptics at Zero Hedge, just what exactly does the president get in return for folding like a cheap chair? Why, pledges to buy more agricultural products, pledges which apparently aren't even enforceable because they're merely firm commitments. In other words, let's take China for their word. So the background for the latest cave says sometime over the past 5 days, the tariff reduction offer was made, and in exchange, the U.S. side has demanded that Beijing make firm commitments to purchase large quantities of U.S. agricultural and other products to better protect U.S. intellectual property rights, oh yeah, that'll fix it, and to allow greater access to China's financial services sector. So at least the big banksters win, and maybe there's a clue. But just one problem, say the wags at Zero Hedge. This is where China balked in the past when they were told to make an unbreakable pledge, and this time was no different. But curiously, a mere pledge was enough for Trump this time around. That said, the Wall Street Journal adds, should China not carry out their pledges as part of the potential deal, the tariffs would return to their original levels. In other words, the dreaded snapback. But come on, that's hardly new. It's SOP for crying out loud. So, here we are, some sort of a deal in which the U.S. gets a promise from China to buy, basically, more pork, which they desperately need anyway, thanks to their pig hyperinflation, is now a virtual lead pipe cinch. And among what now passes for investors, that's cause for overjoyous celebration. So that brings us to the big, high-profile news, and at least one obvious reason for the president's cave. Stocks have rocketed higher, and the bubble just keeps on blowing. And almost as good, at least if you're a bankster, a precious metals paper rally was nipped in the bud. And some of the hidden dots here, your host suggests, may just give us an indication of what else is behind the Trump cave. And no, I'm still not talking about the obvious politics and not much else associated with impeach, impeach, impeach at any cost. But TV host and financial pundit Max Kaiser is talking about things that so many Austrians have been making note of for a number of years now, and that's the potential for a fiat dollar collapse, especially if China decides they've had enough and along with Russia and the other BRICS actually managed to complete the switchover to an alternative to the fiat dollar and along with it the U.S. SWIFT system for international financial transfers in favor of something more real. Kaiser warns that, kind of like what happened with Pearl Harbor, the U.S. will be blindsided the day that China finally introduces its own gold-backed, crypto-based currency, which he calls an absolute game-changer and said would create, quote, a catastrophic trapdoor opening underneath the U.S. economy, unquote. Gee, and you have to wonder, is there any possibility anything even remotely like that came up in the U.S. trade discussions? Anyway, not surprisingly, said Zero Hedge's summary of Kaiser's argument, very few mainstream financial pundits in the West are willing to admit that China probably, almost certainly, possesses gold reserves well in excess by now of 20,000 tons. That's a lot more than they're officially claiming. And by introducing a gold-backed cryptocurrency, it therefore has the ability to, quote, kill the U.S. dollar deader than a doornail. And Kaiser continues, it would be, in fact, a new Pearl Harbor-type event, and he said it's coming in the next 6 to 9 months, which may be an indication of just how far that can's been kicked. That doesn't quite, of course, get it past the next election, but it does at least get it past the great big Christmas buying season and the oh-so-important consumer-driven economy. Can't have people panicking just yet now, can we? And at least for now, stock markets seem happy. And at least when it comes to can kicking, that's good, because prior to Trump's tweet, things were looking decidedly otherwise. Let's take a quick tour of some earlier headlines that have now disappeared in the smoke. Even the Bureau of Lying Statistics, BLS, is confused after jobless claims unexpectedly soared. Huh? The most in over 2 years. They were up by almost 50,000, from a near-cycle low of 203,000 to 252K, far above the 214,000 consensus expectations and the highest print since 2017. But not to worry, other news has dropped off the radar too, like Christine Lagarde, who held her first press conference as the new president of the European Central Bank and dropped a couple of statements that did seem to have markets kind of upset, and even gold and silver were up as a result. Again, of course, that's pre-Trump cave. Number one, said a summary from Zero Hedge, the former IMF head proclaimed confidently that the euro is not seeing Japanification, in spite of what they pointed out was a lot of evidence to the contrary. And second, Lagarde confidently told the listening audience that, quote, negative rates seem to work, even though she admitted the European Central Bank is very aware of the side effects. And you have to ask the question, as they did, working for whom? Lagarde also did admit that labor cost pressures have strengthened, and furthermore, that inflation is coming. Over the medium term, she said, the inflation rate will increase. And additionally, she noted that the European Central Bank's highly accommodative stance, think about those negative rates, will continue for a prolonged period until inflation really does rise. And she said that incoming economic and survey data point to some stabilization in the slowdown of economic growth in the euro area. But nevertheless, the main message about inflation coming did seem to resonate, again, for a while. And not only that, but once the irrational exuberance in the stock market after the Trump cave at least seemed to back off a bit, we have this. There's just one word, said a follow-up concerning the 30-year Treasury auction later this morning, to describe demand for today's $16 billion or so of 30-year Treasury notes. Tremendous. From top to bottom, wrote Zero Hedge, this was one of the strongest auctions on record, aided largely by today's dramatic rout across the yield curve, which built up a substantial concession ahead of the auction. The auction stopped at a yield of 2.307%, well below last month's 2.43%, but more remarkably was something they call the stop-through, which was the highest since January of 2018. In short, says the summary, in the context of today's bond rout driven by the latest rumorgasm, which sent stocks surging and bonds tumbling, the bond market is now saying the sell-off won't last. And the big meltdown may just be beginning. With that in mind, I'm going to go next to something that I approach with some trepidation, because it's a whole lot of inside financial baseball. But we'll see if we can't kind of summarize it and get to the bottom line. Especially since on radio you can't see volumes of charts and graphs anyway, and probably wouldn't want to. And it has to do with that repo market thing that we've talked about a number of times over the last month or so. It's even being called the repocalypse at this point. And Zero Hedge begins the summary that started over the weekend like this. About a month ago, they write, we first laid out how the sequence of liquidity shrinking events that started about a year ago, and which starred the largest U.S. commercial bank, J.P. Morgan, ultimately culminated with the mid-September repo explosion. Specifically, they say, we showed how JPM's drain of liquidity via money markets and reserves parked at the Fed may have prompted the September repo crisis and subsequent launch of not QE by the Fed in order to reduce its at-risk capital and potentially lower what's called the GS1B charge, currently the highest of all major U.S. banks. Basically, the article continues, JPM has been quietly rotating out of cash while repositioning its balance sheet in a major way, and the Financial Times put it this way, we're seeing a, quote, major shift in how the largest U.S. bank by assets manages its enormous balance sheet. Said an executive at a large institutional investor to FT, what JPM did was incredible, adding that, quote, the scale of what JP Morgan is doing is mind-boggling, migrating out of cash into securities while loans are flat. And that dramatic change, which occurred gradually over the year, may have catalyzed the spike in repo rates in September. When the rest of the world suddenly got woke to what was happening, and the overnight general collateral rate briefly did something nobody had ever expected it to do, exploding from 2% to about 10% literally in minutes. An absolutely unprecedented move, and one that many pointed out was generally seen as impossible in a world with an ocean of roughly $1.3 trillion in reserves floating around. All right, here's where the plot thickens. While readers can catch up on the nuances of what JPM did via related posts, the bottom line is that the execution of the plan was flawless. And as they said back at the start of November, to ensure that JPM's tens of billions in buybacks and dividends continue flowing smoothly and enriching the company's shareholders, Jamie Dimon may have held the entire U.S. financial system hostage, forcing the Fed's hand to restart their not QE. And they continued to be sure the mere hint that the September repocalypse was an orchestrated event, are we talking a conspiracy theory here, in some ways similar to the Lehman failure, which ushered in QE1, and it was meant to extract liquidity concessions out of the Fed, call it not QE or QE4, depending upon your semantic persuasion, and at the same time enrich a handful of bank executives, was scandalous enough, and that couldn't be left unaddressed, especially since fears about repo market stability are once again growing. Now that we have just 3 weeks left until the traditionally liquidity-sapping year-end moment. See how many things are coming to a head here at the same time, folks? All right, well, continues the summary to address that and to provide a fascinating new perspective on what may have catalyzed these September 16 events, which were this close, you know, put your thumb and forefinger real close together, to triggering an LTCM, or long-term capital management-like cascade within the markets, the BIS, or Bank of International Settlements, the central banker, De Tutte Central Bankers, over the weekend published a paper as part of its quarterly review entitled September Stress in Dollar Repo Markets, Was It Passing or Structural? Which found several things, says Zero Hedge, that we all already knew. The September event was not a one-off, one-time passing shock to the repo system, contrary to what a bunch of know-it-all financial nitwit accounts claimed, but in fact a structural problem with U.S. liquidity plumbing. And it also found that just 4 commercial banks are now the dominant marginal lenders in the U.S. repo market. And by the way, just one of those, J.P. Morgan, saw its liquidity provisioning collapse in the course of 2019, as has already been talked about. However, in a novel twist, the BIS also found that it was hedge funds that exacerbated the turmoil in the repo market with their thirst for borrowing cash to juice up returns on their trades. Now, here follow a whole bunch more charts and graphs and comments, but let's cut to the chase. What's really new in the BIS paper? It's the idea that cash-hungry hedge funds amplified the existing dislocation, and it was a key factor behind the chaos. The BIS's finding is novel, says the summary, and surprising, because they highlight the growing clout of hedge funds in the repo market, according to none other than the FT, which also notes something Zero Hedge has been talking about for quite a while. Hedge funds like Millennium, Citadel, and Point72 are not only active in the repo markets, they're also the most heavily leveraged multi-strat funds in the world, taking something like maybe $20 or $30 billion in net assets under management and leveraging it up to about $200 billion. Using repo. So you got some of the world's biggest hedge funds active in the repo market to boost their returns. The problem is what happens when repo rates get unhinged. You know, something goes unstable, as happened on September 16th. And it's kind of like what we saw with long-term capital management back in 1998. All of this also explains, they say, why the Fed panicked in response to the GC repo rate blowing out to 10% on September 16th and instantly implemented repos as well in the launch of, well, let's call it QE4, in spite of Fed Chairman Powell. Not only was the Fed chair facing an LTCM-like situation, but because the repo-funded arbitration was abused by most multi-strat funds, the Federal Reserve was suddenly facing a constellation of multiple LTCM-like blow-ups that could have started an avalanche that would have resulted in trillions of dollars of assets being forcefully liquidated as a tsunami of margin calls hit the hedge fund world.
These aren't the droids you're looking for.
These aren't the droids we're looking for. Move along. Move along.
Yeah, not to worry. The Federal Reserve has the situation well in hand, and when have they ever screwed up or even lied to you? So they say the BIS has thus explained, in a few words, how the financial system came close to the verge of collapse on September the 16th, poetically enough, the 11-year anniversary of the Lehman bankruptcy. So here we go. It wasn't so much, it seems, that banks were pulling out from the repo market due to counterparty fears about other banksters. Instead, they were spooked over exposure by other hedge funds, which have become the dominant marginal and, of course, completely unregulated repo counterparty to liquidity lending banks. And without said liquidity, massive hedge fund regulatory leverage, such as that they've been showing for the last few minutes, would become effectively impossible. What does all this mean? Well, the top financial expert at the Bank for International Settlements, Claudio Borio, puts it this way, saying that the September dislocation suggests that such repo events are not only just starting, but that the repo markets, quote, may again find themselves in the eye of the storm should financial stress arise at some point. Gee, folks, could that happen? A point which the U.S. Fed, in their recently revealed FOMC minutes from October, indicated could take place as soon as year end. Which brings me next to something very much related and perhaps even a bit more inside baseball. It's being called Zoltan's Market Doomsday, at least by that tiny bit of the press that's willing to even talk about it. And it refers to a Hungarian fellow named Zoltan Pozsar, whom Zero Hedge introduces as one of the most admired and respected names on Wall Street for at least the past decade. He not only laid the groundwork for our current understanding of the deposit-free shadow banking system, but was also instrumental during his tenure at both the U.S. Treasury and the New York Fed in laying the foundations for the modern repo market, orchestrating the response to the global financial crisis and the ensuing policy debate, because basically nobody at the Fed knows more about what's going on than he does. And since Pozsar moved from the public sector back in 2015 to Credit Suisse to write his market-moving periodical called Global Money Notes, the bottom line remains, when Pozsar speaks or writes, people listen. And in his latest Global Money Notes, number 26, published Tuesday, Pozsar delivered a scathing assessment of the Fed's latest intervention to stabilize repo markets since that September 2016 repocalypse, in which he predicted that the Fed, quote, may lose control of overnight rates, unquote, leading to a vicious dislocation in repos coupled with a paralysis in the foreign exchange swap market. Well, and then what? Well, for one, says Zero Hedge, traders who pretend to understand the implications of what the former Fed strategist said have quietly hunkered down, looking for signs that Pozsar is correct, meaning a worst-case scenario that could lead to a spike in U.S. Treasury yields, a forced deleveraging of hedge funds, and a plunge in equities. In short, they say, a stock market apocalypse. And yeah, you do have to suspect. Wonder if that's what got the president's attention. Well, says Zero Hedge, if he is correct, what are the two things that you need to watch to determine if Repocalypse 2.0 is about to hit? First one's obvious. Look at the repo rate itself. And they note, while the overnight general collateral repo rate remains dormant, the same can't be said about its forward cousin, what's called the turn repo rate, which covers the year-end period of December 31st through January 2nd, and may actually be signaling the turn. The second, and perhaps more critical indicator of a coming market crisis, are foreign exchange swaps, which Pozsar noted could end up as an orphaned asset class without an obvious backstop, and that may force banks in some parts of the world to the edge of the proverbial abyss. As a result, he said, the year-end market's shaping up to be one of the worst in recent memory, and the markets are not pricing in any of this. And there might even, as Zero Hedge has already been hinting, be at least one large U.S. bank actively pushing for a collapse in that market in order to force the Fed to launch their full-blown, no-holds-barred QE4. Furthermore, they note, there are at least three big dates coming up in less than the next week, starting with Friday when the Fed announces their next round of RP operations. that might contribute to the repocalypse that at least Pozar believes is now coming. Bottom line, folks, there's more going on here than just a great big stock market bubble, or a mere impeachment and an attempt to undermine what's left of the rule of law, or even just outright insanity and the continued plan to call evil good and good evil. So there are some of the dots. We'll connect them when we get back right after this.
When I think back on all the crap I learned in high school, it's a wonder I can think at all. And my lack of education hasn't hurt me none. I can read the writing on the wall. Cold or throne.
Welcome back now to the second segment for this evening's show. I'm your host, Mark Hall, and I'm doing something a bit different than I often do. Usually we focus on the news, but this week we're going to focus explicitly on just certain aspects of the news to cut through the impeachment smokescreen and see what I will contend is being deliberately obscured. And I've even got a title tonight. Let's call this show, Follow the Money. Oh, and hurry, too, because ultimately, a lot of times I have taken the approach that, hey, we need to connect some dots. The dots at this point are literally all over the place. We have dots that say the entire world seems to have gone insane, especially the district criminal swamp, Hollyweird, and places like that. We have the impeachment charade and ultimately smokescreen. All of it basically boils down to calling evil good and good evil. I spent most of the first segment talking about the economic insanity and the things that are happening that, if you pay attention, really tell the tale. And the point is, given all the other stuff going on, most people are simply not paying attention. And I have contended for quite some time that if you look and see how the average American is completely oblivious to actual economics, they don't even know who Adam Smith ever was, they have no clue what fascism is, but it is the form of people think it's communism, or it's capitalism. They don't know the difference anyway, but it's the public-private partnership that really is running things. And, if we pay attention, we'll see where it's headed. And that's been part of the point for today. That's why I say follow the money. And as we went to the break, I was outlining some of the things that indicate a lot of really nasty stuff is very close at hand. All right, what I want to do in the second segment is just kick it off with a few of the other dots and smoke screens out there. One of them, of course, is the state of Virginia, which does seem to be occupying front and center position, maybe even ahead of California, for the first shots fired in Civil War 2.0. You have Governor Blackface there, Ralph Northam, one of the, and this is a tall order, but one of the greater scumbags in the United States Governor's Mansion race. He's got some serious competition, obviously, who announced earlier this week that his assault weapons ban means that, well, people in Virginia who are subject to that particular tyranny, and what an irony that is, given that this was once the place where Thomas Jefferson, Patrick Henry, George Washington, James Madison, and a whole bunch of other people that would now be rolling over their graves hailed from. Anyway, in Virginia, gun owners, and that's a really tall order because slaves can't own anything, but gun owners who have AR-15s or any other kind of semi-auto rifle will find one of two choices. Hand it over, or register it, and then hand it over later because we're going to come and take it. And yes, we'll have a grace period for you good little slaves who want to turn them in. Guess what, folks? I have a suspicion that since even in New Zealand and Australia, to a lesser degree, that does not have the history of freedom that the United States does, nor do they have a Second Amendment. They didn't get very many. I bet you in Virginia, where people really do understand what at least once was called the Bill of Rights, it'll be a whole different deal. And earlier in the week, Breitbart reported that dozens more Virginia counties have now declared themselves to be Second Amendment sanctuary counties, vowing not to enforce the utterly unconstitutional infringements that the tyrants there are you know, intent on ramming down people's throat, CNN even admitted that the total number of counties as of earlier in the week in Virginia exceeded 40. But wait, Ammoland reported that by the next day, Tuesday into Wednesday, it was a huge night for gun owners. 18 new sanctuary counties, including Prince William's County, the city of Chesapeake, and Spotsylvania, now bringing the total to 77. And in many, many places, the number of people that turned out to say, hell no, you can't take them, was hundreds, and a whole bunch of them well over 1,000. People are at least recognizing just how serious this has gotten. Maybe something that had to do with it was the story late last week, of course, in Pensacola, where you had yet another gun-free killing zone, and of all places, it was at the Naval Air Station in Pensacola. Turns out it was a Saudi, one of our so-called partners, who was over here going to kill a whole bunch of people. Al-Shamrani was the guy's name, and he even tweeted beforehand that America is a nation of evil. Well, a lot of people needed dying, obviously. And meanwhile, there were three other Saudis that attended some kind of a soiree a couple of nights before that, and at least three of them were watching and filming the attack. Do you think there might be something going on? A.W.R. Hawkins for Breitbart wrote that, yep, gun-free military installations literally make U.S. troops a bunch of sitting ducks. Guess what, folks? If they can do it to U.S. troops, what can't they do to the slaves? They even reiterated the firearms policy at the gun-free killing zone, Naval Air Station Pensacola, as described by the commander, Navy Mid-Atlantic region, noted that, all hands share responsibility for adhering to regulations pertaining to the registration, Achtung, transportation and storage of firearms in the AOR. Basically, the idea is if somebody comes in and wants to kill you, we don't want you to be able to shoot back. The policy also pointed out that state-issued concealed weapons permits are not recognized in any way on any Navy installation. And here's the irony, folks. Whole bunch of these servants of the American people that decided they wanted to fight for their country and the Bill of Rights have been disarmed. And even with a slave permit, you're still not allowed to actually carry, keep, and bear arms. But you can die for your country. I guess you can die disarmed. There was an even more blunt article posted from Ammoland that said, once again, our bases are all gigantic gun-free killing zones where defenseless armed forces await to be murdered by armed terrorists, while their professing commanders are petrified by the very thought of deploying competently armed warriors during an actual attack. If this had been an actual attack, of course, we'd open the borders like they're doing, well, on the Mexico border with New Mexico, Texas, and so forth, out to the People's Republic of California. Changing gears, but not too much, just one amendment or so away. John Solomon, who's been involved in reporting on what's really going on with the impeachment charade, slammed Adam Schiff for brains, and I'm going to pronounce that carefully, but this guy, folks, is right up there at the top of the evil category as well, and what he calls, correctly, a chilling effect on press freedom. Now, note that even the FBI, which doesn't seem to have a great reputation lately for paying attention to the Constitution, does have what they call a Domestic Investigations and Operations Guide, the so-called Bible for agents, and it's long recognized that journalists, the clergy, lawyers have special protections because of the constitutional implications, read that First Amendment sometime, of investigating their work. So, the FBI and Department of Justice, once upon a time, at least, created specific rules governing agents' actions involving special circumstances professionals. All right, this is just a bunch of way of saying that since they got rid of the First Amendment, at least there were a few professions, clergy, lawyers, and, journalists, but we don't have many of those anymore outside of John Solomon, do we, that enjoyed still some protection in spite of we don't need no stinking warrants. Well, earlier in the year, the so-called Intelligence Committee chairman, the shifty one, secretly authorized subpoenas to AT&T for the phone records of, well, one of them, a lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, the president's personal attorney, and another associate, and then he went to arbitrarily extract information about certain private calls and made them public. Don't try this at home, folks. Unless you're the shiftless one, you might go to jail. Other people, though, that pointed out might get impeached. Many of the calls Mr. Schiff chose to publicize fell into special circumstances categories. The aforementioned lawyers, one member of Congress, Devin Nunes, Intelligence Committee's ranking Republican, and a journalist, says John Solomon, that would be him. And more alarming, the released call records involve figures that have criticized or clashed with the shifty one. It seems like what it's all about is punishing people that resist the juggernaut of the deep state. Gee, does that surprise us at all? From there, I want to go to a quick story, a couple of comments from a movie that I would encourage people to watch. We're throwing out some dots. Maybe the dots don't even need to be connected at this point. Some of these dots, I think, are going to self-connect. But this is a piece from The Burning Platform and Doug Uncola Lynn, who pointed out this movie that I have always thought was a really enjoyable and kind of prophetic effort by John Carpenter from 1988, the cult science fiction classic called They Live. If you've ever seen it, you probably recognize it. It was originally in black and white. I think they've colorized it now. But a guy finds a pair of glasses. He puts on the glasses and shazam! He can see the world for what it really is, and it's really ugly. Now, this is the one of the conclusions from the movie that I think is a pretty good summary. And think about it, folks. Perhaps of all the movies over recent decades, They Live is very close to the top of the list of pointing out where we are and what's happened. Obviously, the Terminator series, for a whole different set of reasons, and the threat of AI is another one. And, of course, let's not forget The Matrix, because take the red pill as opposed to the, if you take the blue pill, you don't wake up. You stay woke, and you think you're living in the real world, but you're about as far from it as you can get. All right, back to the quote from They Live. Our impulses are being redirected. We are living in an artificially induced state of consciousness that resembles sleep. The poor and the underclass are growing. Racial justice and human rights are non-existent. So, of course, is the Bill of Rights. They've created a repressive society, and we are their unwitting accomplices. Their intention to rule rests with the annihilation of consciousness. We've been lulled into a trance. They've made us indifferent to ourselves, to others. We're focused only on our own gain, or maybe our cell phone nowadays. Please understand, they're safe as long as they are not discovered. That's their primary method of survival, to keep us asleep, to keep us selfish, to keep us sedated. And essentially, the story here from the Uncola guy goes on to point out that the classic film They Live so foreshadowed our current time that it's downright chilling. How they lull the masses to sleep with advertising and materialism and so forth. People run around in a dreamlike state. They were treated like puppets and surveilled. Oh, and ready for this? Watch the movie again. By flying drones, no less. Hey, what's the bottom line? Well, we know it. It's all about consolidating power and maintaining control over the dupes, the deplorables. Fill in the blank, the things that Hitler and Obama and all of those leftists basically say. They want to call you, and of course they may call you dead once they finish disarming you. That seems to be the chief piece that stands in their way. Now, this was an interesting observation. I'll mention this. The rest of the article from the Uncola Lynn goes on to point out that, if you look at the impeachment scam, you can see so much of this playing out. Been there, done that. I want to go somewhere else for the rest of the show today. But he does say this, wherever we hear highly elected officials, talking heads in the media, former and high-ranking officials in government, pontificating about the Horowitz report this week, FISA abuse, and the claim that they found, get this, no evidence of political bias. Well, we all know it's a pack of lies. Now, think about that in context, because this is what I think really ought to arouse people's suspicions. You got a whole bunch of people saying, we're going to impeach this president. We don't need any stinking evidence. We couldn't find any evidence. We worked hard. We spent lots of money. We made it up. We broke the Fourth Amendment. We pretty well gang-raped the rule of law. Couldn't find any evidence. And maybe it's no surprise that people couldn't find any evidence when there wasn't any. Actually couldn't find any evidence when there was a whole bunch of it, of bias. Because all of the errors in the Horowitz report, they all fell in one direction. They all basically said, we're going to get this guy, the president, and we don't care about the evidence. So, again, that shouldn't surprise us, but it does at least kind of help to make the point. Next, just a couple of comments from another piece that's certainly worth talking about. But, again, what I'm doing here, folks, is throwing out dots. And I want to try to make this point, and that's why I'm even talking fast today. So many dots, so much insanity, and so much calling evil good and good evil. We spent most of the first segment talking about economics. And now I want to at least go to Brandon Smith from altmarket.com. Who are the globalists, he asks, and what do they want? Well, we've talked about this a number of times. Frankly, he says their agenda's become more open than ever over the last few years. Once upon a time, if you even talked about them, you were called a conspiracy theorist, tinfoil hat-wearing lunatic, and so forth. Well, now the insanity is so widespread that if you're sane, they call you insane by comparison, along with calling evil good and vice versa. He goes on to point out that I can remember when people talked about the dethronement of the almighty fiat U.S. dollar, replaced with a new one world order currency, cashless society, controlled by the IMF. All of that was a bizarre conspiracy theory, but now it's being openly called for by the financial press, the economic governance, and most of the EU, and so forth. You can't really claim it's a conspiracy theory anymore. Essentially, everything the liberty movement's been warning about, he says, has not only come to pass, but it's probably a lot worse because they were soft-pedaling it. People didn't believe it then. Now they have to wake up to where it's actually headed. The argument about whether or not a globalist agenda exists, says Brandon Smith, is over. The liberty movement, at least in theory, won that debate because now they're admitting it. They're not hiding it anymore. And the mainstream doesn't really deny that globalists exist. They just try to convince you it's a good thing. Now, he says they're arguing about whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. I'm going to say no. There's no argument anymore. As far as they're concerned, it's the only thing. And I'll briefly get to another story in just a minute that kind of makes that point. Well, we'll do it right now. Does anyone even care nowadays, says the 5-Minute Forecast and the Daily Reckoning. Some very good Austrian-oriented economists. Does anyone really care nowadays who's named Time's so-called Person of the Year? Well, answer. Good grief. If you haven't seen this, Greta Thunberg. And that's all I'm going to say about it, folks, because essentially when they pick a little chattering ninny that has a real problem with anger management, it shows you how far gone things are and that insanity really is what is mainstream. He goes on to point out, the author here, that the most striking thing when you watch or listen to news coverage of Greta and all the demonstrations, that her highly funded globalist agenda, they picked her, folks, she didn't emerge to prominence, are forever demanding, is that somebody somewhere take action. Well, they rarely even talk about what those actions should be. Well, except for, of course, they mean more global control and less freedom for you. They quote a typical Thunberg bit of idiocy. Quote, "It feels like we're at a breaking point. Leaders know that more than eyes that's on them, much more pressure is on them, that they have to do something. They have to come up with some sort of solution. I want a concrete plan, not just nice words." Well, they continue for years now, well before Greta burst on the scene. We've all been saying, and so has your host, that the climate change scare, they usually don't even say man-made anymore because it's pretty obvious that there's a whole lot more than that going on, isn't about carbon or even about climate. It's all about control. He quotes Catherine Austin Fitz, who's a very good economist and, bean counter even, who's been talking about some of this evil for years. Back in 2014, she said the following. Let me tell you what the most dangerous policy action in the world is. It's to decide that some phenomenon, such as climate change, is our number one problem. We need to take urgent action on it before understanding who's going to control the policy discussion and implement the so-called solutions. Build a consensus, with the UN plan. The Delphi method, that man-made climate change is our number one problem. And I assure you, she says, that our mystery governance system will ultimately use it to achieve a global taxation system and a more centralized control. Jim Rickards put it this way, climate change is a convenient horse for elites to ride in the implementation of their new world order. He went on to say climate change is the perfect platform for implementing a hidden agenda of world money and world taxation. So, if all of that's the case, continues the Daily Reckoning here, then what's the elite hidden agenda, and why is it using climate alarmism as a Trojan horse? Well, because climate change doesn't respect political borders. Any response to climate change, therefore, must ignore borders, too, just like Congress. In short, climate change is an excuse for, fill it all in. Global governance, global taxation, and intervention in the internal affairs of sovereign states by unelected global bureaucrats. It's all about, you might even call it the global reset. And that's essentially what I'm suggesting all of these dots connect and lead to. And it's part of the reason why there's so much smoke about impeach, 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 the hell with the Bill of Rights, we need to get you all disarmed, because ultimately, folks, follow the money really is important. And if people fail to do that, and they fail to recognize how all of these dots connect in the same direction, as I have been saying for literally years at this point, they won't wake up and realize how far gone they are until they walk into a Walmart or whatever's left and find the shelves empty. And by that time, exactly as intended, it's too late. So here is one more bit of advice from the Daily Reckoning about QE, quantitative easing, and of course that means money printing to infinity, and it's much closer than you think. Now, they're going to basically pick up on some themes that I went into some detail about in the first segment, so if you need to, re-listen to that. But the next round of quantitative easing, they predict, official, actual, as opposed to not QE, what they're now calling it, is fast approaching. Yep, the Federal Reserve will soon be cleared for, say it with me, emergency action. And when can we expect it? Well, first, we need to distinguish between official QE, the kind they actually admit, and the not QE that we've been having, QE light. Now, they go on to say the idea of quantitative easing, at least they claim it has a strategic vision. It's to stimulate, to prevent the big meltdown. The meltdown that they're not even going to admit is a possibility now until it's too late. QE Lite, though, lacks all strategic vision. Wait a minute. Here's where I disagree just a bit with the Daily Reckoning. I know that's not the point they're making, but ultimately it does have a strategic vision. They're just not going to tell you. It has an end point. It's the global currency reset. Meanwhile, though, there's a technical kind of thing going on. It simply fills a leakage somewhere within the financial plumbing. Now, this is the official story, right? Federal Reserve balance sheet was at $3.8 trillion back in September, but here it is, not very much longer, and now it's up to almost $1 trillion. On Monday alone, the New York crew emptied over $81 billion of liquidity. They've been pumping, pumping, pumping. But wait. We're assured none of it has seeped into the central water lines of the stock exchanges. The additional money that's been printed lacks a direct transmission mechanism to the equity markets or to other long-duration risk assets. That's supposed to make it safe. But, says Matthew Miskin, John Hancock, co-chief investment strategist, QE Lite is kind of like a fourth rate cut this year. Meanwhile, though, Jerome Powell, Fed chair, claims QE Lite has patched the financial plumbing. Don't worry, all the valves are shut. But independent inspectors are far from convinced, says the 5-minute forecast and Daily Reckoning. Some of them see not just patched leaks, but ongoing hemorrhages. They quote James Bianco of his own research company. The big picture and the answer is that the repo market is broken. They're essentially medicating the market into submission. But this is not a long-term solution. This situation is now far bigger than anyone thought it was ever going to be. I think they're hoping the market will magically fix itself. Well, he may be thinking that or suggesting it. Nobody believes that. I don't see why it should, he says, nor does the 5-minute forecast or Daily Reckoning, Agora. The Federal Reserve is now 3 months deep into these temporary open market operations, and, said Powell, by his own admission, they'll run at least into the second quarter of 2020. We'll bet, says the Daily Reckoning, they'll go into the third quarter, probably the fourth too. But why, oh why, have the Federal Reserve's heroic floods of money, liquidity anyway, failed to fill the pipes? Answer. It can pump, and it has, but it can't guarantee that it sloshes through to, well, at least what the claimed intended destination is. Some of us would suggest the claimed destination shouldn't be confused with the intended destination. Guess where it's really going. Clogs, though, may bottle it up. And there are a whole lot of big financial institutions. They go on to say that there are 24 banks, primary dealers, that have direct lines into the liquidity taps. They transact directly with the Federal Reserve. From these primary dealers, that liquidity is supposed to go sluicing out into the repo market. But our minions inform us that over 70 such financial institutions are still going without. hence the liquidity shortage. Now, I mentioned in the first segment the BIS, the Bankster's Bank, that has reached the same conclusion. They pointed out four banks in particular, yet, did you notice this? They failed to identify the culprits, for what that's worth. But here's the problem. The big banks are just hoarding cash, telling the Fed they've got more than enough cash and excess reserves to meet the regulatory issues, but hey, given that interest rates are so low, they can earn more in other ways. The elevated post-crash requirements incentivize banks to pile up reserves. Who wants to loan it out at very, very low rates anyway? So, guess what they do? Hence the prediction, and we talked about this, of Zoltan Pozar, who essentially says, expect QE4 real soon now. Your host is going to summarize all of this, folks, okay? You connect the dots and you realize the elephant in the room is that the financial apocalypse, the repocalypse, the meltdown, when the financial juice does come sluicing through the pipes and hemorrhaging out everywhere, is closer than anybody wants to admit. That includes the president. That includes the Congress, and they would all rather just distract you with the three-ring circus until it's way too late. So yeah, follow the money, brace yourself for what's coming, especially when it comes to who we serve and the supreme law. And if you know just how close we are, you better hurry, too.